global fixed income markets are very much in focus for investors heading into 2025. With credit spreads tight and the geopolitical environment changing rapidly, investors are rightly wondering where, across the global fixed income spectrum, they can potentially earn attractive returns in the year ahead. Welcome to the Barings 2025 Global Fixed Income Outlook, where our panel of experts across high-yield bonds and loans, investment-grade corporate credit, and sovereign and emerging markets debt will discuss and debate the prospects for the year ahead. The following conversation was broadcast as a live webinar for Barings clients. If you'd like to access a written version of this conversation adapted from the full discussion, please visit barings.com. With that, here is your moderator for the discussion, Colin Gordon.
Hello, and welcome to the Barings 2025 Public Fixed Income Outlook. Our theme this year is navigating a shifting landscape. My name is Colin Gordon, and I have the privilege of hosting a discussion today with four of Barings' most distinguished portfolio managers. If you would each introduce yourself and tell us your role here at Barings, that'd be great. Let's start with Charles.
My name is Charles Sanford. I manage the global investment grade corporate business, and my day job is to be the portfolio manager for our global insurance accounts.
Thanks very much. Ricardo.
My name is Ricardo Adrogué, and I lead global sovereign debt and currencies at Barings.
And over to Tunde.
Hi, my name is Amatunde Dalal, and I run the EMEA corporate credit business.
Last but not least, Brian.
Brian Pacheco, portfolio manager focused on global high yield and multi-asset credit.
Let's start with a quick lightning question just to get the discussion going. Markets, as efficient as they might be, are almost always wrong about something. What's the market wrong about right now? We'll all have a chance at this, and we can go into sort of more depth later in the conversation, but a quick answer from each of you. Let's start with Ricardo.
I think the market is probably underpricing inflation now.
Okay, we certainly will come back to that. Tunde?
I think, without having a crystal ball, that perhaps the market is underestimating China's willingness to do something more if needed.
Brian?
Sort of similar to Ricardo, but term premium, I think 5 basis points between the twos and tens is just too flat.
Okay, and finally, Charles.
And I think the technicals are overwhelming the fundamentals, and so I don't think the market is really pricing in spread volatility that could emerge later in the year.
Okay, we definitely will come back to that later. We've just had what is possibly one of the most consequential elections in our careers, if not our lifetimes. What does a Trump victory mean for each of your markets? Brian, I'll start with you.
So in general, it means higher growth, I think less regulation. The market was sort of very quick to price that in. So the real question for us next year is going to be to determine how much is priced in relative to what spreads are implying. But it generally means higher growth. Duration is short and high yield, so maybe not as impactful as it is in other markets.
Have you seen any sectors affected? I guess I would have thought energy might be one that would have responded, or have you not seen that in the price yet?
Well, so energy is interesting. You saw a big rally in energy equities, but it's unclear whether drill, baby, drill is necessarily good. It means less regulation, more supply, but regulation is not really what has been holding back energy supply. It's price. And then, of course, there's the demand and geopolitical element. So I think energy, it's not really clear. Other industries like healthcare, also some regulatory implications. So the market is still sorting that out, but the moves in response have not been that significant as of yet.
Fantastic. Ricardo, let's pivot to you. What does a Trump victory mean for your market? Your market is quite broad.
Much like Brian was saying, growth, strong growth, especially led by the US, will potentially result in stronger dollar. So weaker euro, difficult to see the Japanese yen weakening further, but potentially so strong dollar. At some point, potentially slightly higher inflation, especially in the US, depending on what policies are being implemented in the short term, which also means potentially higher US Treasury yields from where we are. Much like Brian said, the market has priced in quite a bit initially, right after the election, but we perceive that there's enough out there that people think that there could be more moderation, which we tend to disagree. We think that policy will be quite pro-growth, strong growth, and strong dollar.
Charles?
I think regulations will be laxer. And so the real beneficiary of that is financials. And it's really going to be the big six money center banks as well as other money center banks. And it is interesting. You've already seen spreads rally probably 15 basis points right off the bat. And so they will definitely be beneficiaries. Brian brought up a great point on energy, and that really will be an interesting dynamic because those companies got punished so much in 15 and 16 that it really is sort of price and Wall Street that sort of regulate the amount of oil that's coming out of the ground. And so I have a feeling, even though we are in a drill baby drill kind of scenario, that they probably will not increase their production that much more. And just to say it, they actually have hit new highs. They just hit 13.4 million barrels a day back in August. And so even during the very sort of strict Biden regulatory regime, they have been able to get to all-time highs in terms of drilling in the U.S. So that's interesting. But tariffs are going to hurt retail, and so there's going to be a lot of pressure on supply chains probably, and then input costs are going to be higher. And so we would expect retail spreads to widen out a little bit. And then the other big area is going to be M&A. And so I think there'll be a lot laxer sort of regulation around M&A. And so sectors like communications, technology, and pharmaceuticals, we will probably see animal spirits running wild.
Excellent. Tunde, let's finish off with you.
All right. Okay. So I've got two hats on, so I'll go through both. So for Europe, I'd say Trump, this Trump 2.0, really, the impact of being sort of well documented is that, you know, potentially causes a lot more uncertainty in terms of what we might see for the corporate credit landscape in Europe as regards to tariffs. Above all else, actually, for both EM and Europe, I think it's the uncertainty that a Trump administration brings. It's not knowing how to pivot and how to react until he actually gives some direction of where he's going to go. But for Europe, I think it's generically how the European corporates will cope with any tariffs or potential tariffs. And for EM, it's actually quite a mixed bag. It's not just a lose-lose. There's some winners and some losers. I think the big thing and the big elephant in the room is always China when it comes to EM with regards to Trump. But actually, the last Trump administration, all that really showed us was a bit more of a reorientation of trade from China to other parts of the world. And so actually, potentially, whilst you've got the headline news around China and tariffs from Trump, potentially they're winners and losers. There's going to be commodity exporters who are going to be winners, and there's going to be sort of strong domestic economies that are more resilient within themselves that are going to be winners. And naturally, there will be some losers as well.
The one part that I failed to mention is within the sovereign and emerging market space, much like what Tunde is saying, the high yield component should see a benefit. Strong growth pulled by the U.S. is actually positive for credit, sovereign credit in particular too. It may not be as positive for some emerging market currencies, but those tend to be the more liquid, bigger countries. So positive for credit, maybe not so positive for currencies.
That's really helpful. Let's pivot to a little bit of that uncertainty. You know, the world does look like a fairly uncertain slash risky place right now, from natural disasters to multiple geopolitical hotspots, including wars, to a fair amount of uncertainty about both fiscal and monetary paths going forward. But prices aren't really reflecting that uncertainty. Spreads keep grinding tighter. Valuations keep grinding higher. For each of you, is there a disconnect between what you're seeing from the top down and the bottom up? And how resilient are your markets to exogenous shocks right now?
So my take is that momentum seems to be one of the key drivers of asset prices, much more than I had seen it historically. It's difficult to not see a market that has gone up in recent times continue to go up, and vice versa. There is, from my perspective, big discontinuities in the market, which are the price of gold, such as one thing. The ratio of copper to gold suggests a different thing. The price of equities in the U.S. suggests a third thing. So there's very mixed messages at the top-down level. And so going from bottom up is the way we tend to approach and has been very successful.
Okay. Anybody else want to comment on that top-down versus bottom-up? Brian, let's pivot to you.
Sure. Well, I think the direction of travel matters most here. You could argue we're past peak inflation, we're past peak recession fears, and we're arguably past peak geopolitical fears. So while all of those risks are present in some degree, things are moderating, and credit loves moderation. So I think it's consistent that you're seeing spreads tighter. From a bottom-up versus top-down perspective. Bottom-up, we're seeing moderation and sort of stable results overall, but there are pockets of weakness, certain areas of retail that touches the lower-end consumer, for example. And then there's other markets that are doing just fine, and you wouldn't realize that anything's wrong. So bottom-up is mixed. I think that tends to drive most of our investment decisions at Barings in general, and particularly in an uncertain macroeconomic environment. But I would say overall that spreads are tight for a reason, and we don't have a strong disagreement with that within high yield.
If I could just jump in there very quickly, I'd say that very much like what Brian is saying, it's when you look at the fundamentals and you look at the technicals, that does support what we're seeing from a spreads perspective. You know, I look at fundamentals. In Europe, we're seeing multiple times the number of upgrades to downgrades in terms of ratings, corporate ratings actions. We're seeing corporate earnings are actually much recovered post-COVID. Very same phenomenon playing out in emerging markets as well. We're seeing sort of high single-digit top-line growth. We're seeing EBITDA margins recovered post the sort of shock that we have from Russia-Ukraine invasion. Technicals are quite strong in Europe. You've seen inflows. You've seen a sort of muted supply. Within EM as well, very similar. You're seeing much muted supply and actually negative net financing in EM. So actually, technicals are supportive. Fundamentals are quite good. We're seeing sort of positive ratings trajectory across both markets. So you can understand why spreads are sort of grinding tighter as they are. But like we always say, it's not just about the spreads. It's about the absolute yields. The absolute yields are still looking attractive. So it still does make sense if you are allocating to allocate to these high yield strategies.
I do see that the general perception is geopolitical risk are on the wane, that the US election has resulted in a potentially much better global geopolitical outlook. There's some part of it that nags me because it is true that politics in the US will become, as it refers to the rest of the world, will become significantly more volatile. And so having a more volatile US could result in others becoming more conservative, more worried about what the US could do, or it could be a free-for-all to a larger extent. So I'm not sure where I land. I do see the market focusing, like Brian was saying, it seems that we believe that Ukraine, Russia will get along much better because Trump will resolve it. The market has pricing Ukrainian bonds going up crazy, even though obviously I would suggest that this is a net loss for Ukraine. But the outcome is that people believe that there will be peace. Peace there, peace in the Middle East, and also peace with China. I'm not 100% convinced of that story.
Charles, it sounds like our other panelists are saying, hey, yes, the world does look like a risky place. But if you look down at the facts, the companies that you're studying, actually, the fundamentals and technicals are quite good and justify the spreads and stay invested. Do you agree with that, or do you take the other side of that?
So I'd say yes, but. And so I think that the technicals are just ridiculous. And so literally every week, every Monday morning, I wake up and I get sort of the amount of money flowing into the asset class. And it's been between sort of like $4 and $8 billion a week. And so there's just this flood of money coming in. A lot of it's from annuities. Fundamentals are very good, but, you know, leverage is creeping up, you know, EBITDA margin is okay, but it's not great. And so, and then I would say it's really a matter of degree. And so I think spreads should be tight. But right before the election, the credit index was at 77 basis points. And that literally was tied for the post-great financial crisis tights. And then right after the election, we're down at 71. And so we're through great financial crisis tights. And so that I don't think is justified. And so I think there will be more volatility. You know, technicals and fundamentals are fairly good, but not nearly that good.
Let's pivot a little bit. We've been talking about most of the U.S. And the rest of the world just now. But now let's look at U.S. and Europe. I think markets have been telling you recently that they're headed in quite different directions. You know, do we agree with that? Are there implications for your asset classes? Charles, I'll stay with you on this one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to benefit dollar-denominated spreads sort of much better than it will European spreads. And we actually have models which sort of compare them on a duration-adjusted basis. And that is indeed what it has showed. And so we actually have seen some cheapness arise in sort of the dollar side of the market relative to euro and sterling. And I think from a fundamental perspective, that is justified.
Ricardo, thoughts on U.S. versus Europe?
Yes, they are going different directions now. People tend to talk about America exceptionalism. The truth is, the shocks that Europe has been subject to have been all been negative. So Europe saw a big spike in energy costs when they decided, when Russia invaded Ukraine, and Europe followed the US lead in saying, we don't buy our oil and gas to as much as we can from Russia anymore. So we are going to buy it from the US at much more expensive prices. That is a negative shock for Europe. Moreover, thanks to President Trump's first presidency, Europe started spending a lot more in arms, and when Russia invaded Ukraine, decided to double down. Now, they do not have the military suppliers the US has. So that's another source of negative shock for the European economy that is benefiting the US. So I won't argue that the US is not an exceptional economy, an exceptional place, but when you actually analyze the economic factors behind the problems that Europe is facing, they are real shocks that Europe has been adjusting quite nicely. So our perception is that Europe has not become that much less productive as an economy. It is going through a cyclical downturn that at some point will turn around, which that means is lower interest rates in Europe, potentially, as Jeff was saying, higher interest rates in the US. The spread differential will in between interest rates will get wider, and potentially that will strengthen the dollar against the euro.
Tunde, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with parts of that. And what I was going to highlight is when we talk about sort of US versus Europe, I think it's also quite important for us to talk about the different perspectives within US and Europe. Yes, from a sovereign perspective, all the points that Ricardo makes are very true in that you're going to have that much pressure and potentially you're going to have to see the ECB roll. But actually, interestingly, what we've observed for much of the last several months has been that bifurcation, even within Europe in itself. We've seen sort of core Europe a lot slower versus peripheral Europe. And when we look at some of the corporates that are in that, some of the corporates there actually have been quite resilient despite that sort of downward trending Eurozone PMI data that we've seen. And that what's that showing us is actually the more global footprint of a lot of these sort of European largely investment grade corporates that we're seeing as well. So although, you know, the expectation is a Trump presidency potentially is negative for Europe, or maybe, you know, US exceptionalism will play out under Trump with the tax cuts and all of that, actually, I wouldn't rule out Europe, especially the higher quality end of Europe, because a lot of those companies that are there are actually quite resilient because they are actually really global in themselves.
Brian, I think you have something to add.
Yeah, well, she actually sort of made the exact comment I was going to make, where within high yield is tricky because if you look at the index level, the high yield credits are actually in better shape in Europe, meaning they're higher rated, they have more liquidity, better balance sheets. So although the economic differences are stark, it's a little bit more nuanced when you look at things from a bottom up perspective, which market is better. And right now we're pretty neutral in that that bottom up selection is kind of driving our allocation a little bit more than top down.
Let's pivot a little bit to, you know, we've looked at a lot of things sort of on a global macro basis. Let's pivot to a few sector specific questions. And Brian, I'll stay with you. High yield maturity walls. We hear all about them. Do we believe them? If we do believe them, how should we play them?
Well, high yield maturity walls are real, but I think they are an asset instead of a liability, which is tough for some investors to wrap their head around. But what I mean by that is the market, the high yield market is as high quality as it's arguably ever been. We're about 55% double Bs globally, and the market is still trading at a discount to par. The market is very short. Your duration, effective duration, is around 3 years. So what that means is there's not a lot of price sensitivity to spread widening. And in fact, when you're facing a maturity wall, you're trading below par. High yield companies typically refinance 12 to 18 months in front of that maturity. So on those securities that are maturing, that are trading below par, that are refinanced early, you're earning a higher return than your yield to worst on your screen, because effectively you're trading yield to call. So there's a big portion of the market that sort of fits that dynamic. And those are assets you want to own to the extent that the market is open. And the market is wide open for the vast majority of the index.
And of course, you're only going to feel that bullish if you're absolutely comfortable with the underlying credit, right? The ability for that company to actually refi and basically cash you out at par. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. And to the extent the market had a lot of triple C's with near dated maturities, you might be more concerned. But triple C's are as small a portion of the overall index as they've been in a long time.
Understood. I'll move to Ricardo. Ricardo, I don't think I've ever seen you as bullish as I have in the last 4 or 5 months. What has gotten you so excited about your asset class in the coming couple of years?
So the credit side, especially on the emerging market credit side, we think that the high yield component has a lot more room to run. So it has had a pretty nice rally so far. And the reason is that some of those countries that went into the 2020 COVID crisis with the recommendation that they should stop paying their debts saw their prices going into very distressed levels. And when I say they were recommended by the multilaterals, by the International Monetary Fund, by the World Bank, they were told they were not going to be able to repay their debts. So best they could do was to just default and start restructuring. Some of them did. Some of them went into default. And then it took so long for them to go back into the market. Some of them are still renegotiating their debts that now the IMF and the World Bank are changing their rhetoric again and say, no, they're all liquidity crises. So we're seeing a lot of countries that have their spreads that are really very wide because they are discounting a high probability of default because they're still looking at what happened post-COVID when the world has changed. And so those are the Argentina-like credits or the Sri Lanka-like credits that have a lot more room to rally.
I'll switch to Charles. Charles, earlier you touched on annuities and insurance capital. Mm-hmm. Insurance capital is a huge and growing part of what your team focuses on. How has insurance capital really changed the dynamics of your market in the last couple of years?
Honestly, this has been a fascinating topic. And so this has changed not just the way Barings operates, but also the way the whole sell side is structured. And so because annuity flows are much more sensitive and annuity flows are sort of the area of the insurance world that has really taken off relative to the whole life side of the equation. And because annuity flows need to be put to work a lot faster, it has changed the way that trades happen. And so portfolio trading has really taken off in the past year, sort of coincidentally with sort of the growth in annuity sales. With whole life policies, you don't want to wait forever, but you typically have a little bit of time before you need to get the money invested. With annuity flows, it's really like a couple of days. And so portfolio trading has taken off such that it takes about 20% of the market right now. And at most sell side firms, literally the structure of the trading operation has changed so that the portfolio trading is a center of a hub and spoke system now that takes into account the algorithmic trading, the voice trading, the ETF trading, and then all the portfolio trading. So we can put, $1 billion to work in a couple hours now. And that is really how it's changed relative to the way that we had been handling whole life flows, which is more of an order by order kind of basis.
So and again, at the broad level, just another real huge force driving spreads tighter in terms of having to put that annuity money to work, at speed and in volume.
Driving spreads tighter and changing the credit curve because it is really focused on the front end of the curve. And so it's really steepening the front end of the curve.
Got it. Tony, let's pivot to you. Your remit is quite broad. Let's just touch on EM corporate debt for a second. EM corporate debt is a massive market. It has had very stark winners and losers over the last couple of years. Some investors, have been burned by it. What would you say to the corporate investor, to the institutional investor, about how EM corporate debt should be part of their portfolio?
I mean, it's no secret, but EM corporate debt EM as a whole has had a very exciting last few years for sure. And we've certainly partaken in some of that excitement. But I think, this is what makes the market. There's going to be ebbs and flows, right? And so really what we've seen over the last few years is perhaps some of the ebbs to this. But the argument to an investor who's been allocated to the asset class who feels perhaps the returns didn't quite justify what they were wanting, is to point them towards the sort of longer-term Sharpe ratios of the asset class. Despite all the volatility that we've had post-COVID with Russia, Ukraine, and with China, the Sharpe ratios actually still look pretty compelling. The other thing that I would say really is look at the fundamentals. What you're buying into where you're getting that spread pickup is actually very many times and very often is actually superior fundamentals to the equivalent that you would allocate to as well. So I would urge you to look under the hood, look at the fundamentals of what you're really buying and compare it to what you would allocate to. And then the final argument there is really just about the sort of correlation effects or the lack of correlation between some of the other asset classes. EM corporate debt can be a diversifier, depending on what else you have in your portfolio, in your asset allocation model. It's a diversifier. It's got superior Sharpe ratios, and the fundamentals are actually superior to some of the other things that you would allocate to.
And if I may, I would second that. As Trudy says, EM corporates look attractive. EM in general looks attractive. It is a diversifier. But one thing that people tend to forget is that most of us have been investing the last 15 years on a regime, global monetary regime, that is very different than what we are going about to face again now, meaning we were in quantitative easing throughout that period. And quantitative easing means that the Fed, in this case, buys U.S. assets. So it is understandable that U.S. assets that have a put. So if an investor, high-yield investor, U.S. investor, in 2020 had a high-yield bond that they didn't like, the Fed came in and said, by the way, I will be willing to buy your high-yield bond. But nobody said from the Fed, or couldn't say, we will be buying your emerging market bond, corporate or sovereign, right? What we're about to go into now is a very different scenario because the Fed is on quantitative tightening. The Fed is not exercising or coming close to exercising that put, and is giving the money, allowing the banks, global commercial banks, which are in great shape, to invest according to those numbers that Tunde has mentioned. So that is completely missing the market. The market is looking a different way. They're looking at the past 15 years. They're not thinking in the future.
And if I may, just one final point, not to belabor the point, but oftentimes it's a misconception when people think EM is volatile. No, EM is not a monolith. EM as an asset class is 80 plus countries. Yes, you might have a dictator in one country or a dictator in two different countries causing headlines, but it's an asset class that's underlied by 80 different countries with 80 different business cycles, 80 different political cycles. You know, there will always be winners and losers. You look at the market's increasing ability to isolate events happening in different parts of the world without it causing contagion to the asset class. That, to me, is an asset class that is a true diversifier.
That's very compelling from both of you. Let's pivot over to high-yield bonds. Brian, for many investors, default rates feel low. It feels like we're headed for higher default rates because it feels like the end of a credit cycle. Is that true, or is the market structurally changed?
High yield, I would say the market has structurally changed. I sort of alluded to that earlier, just with the percentage of higher quality credits you have in the index at 55% and the lower percentage of triple Cs, sort of by definition, you are going to have a lower default rate going forward. I think another thing that's contributed to low default rates is just the massive suppression in interest rates we had post-COVID and the refinancing wave that came out of that. So a lot of these high-yield credits have pushed out maturities, particularly riskier credits. So there's not, in order to default, you sort of need a catalyst. The most common catalyst is a maturity. And as we talked about earlier, maturities are only a problem if you can't access credit markets. So while we do think defaults could tick up as the economy weakens over the next several years, we're not expecting anything dramatic.
Let's pivot again to sort of where we are in that cycle. We've been talking about certainly on the credit side that it feels late in cycle to many investors. All of you have invested through many cycles in your long careers. What feels different about this one? And Charles, I'll start with you.
I'm not really sure we are that late in the cycle. I mean, it does not feel like we have any huge built-up imbalances like we did pre-GFC, where you had all sorts of leverage in the system. It's not like, you know, during the energy crisis or before the energy crisis when the companies got all levered up, or, you know, there are periods we went through when companies went through wild M&A sprees and, you know, investment-grade companies levered up to six to sort of acquire companies. And so, you know, while spreads are very, very tight and spreads have been very tight for a long time, you could see this drifting on for quite some time. And so I wouldn't say we're in like the eighth inning. I mean, we could be still relatively early in terms of where the spread cycle is anyway.
Dr. Droge, how does this feel to you right now?
Sure, it's interesting because I fully agree with what Charles is saying. And there is data behind it too. At the macro level, the Institute of International Finance collects data on global debt. And the global debt stock has remained steady, 100% steady since the 2008 financial crisis. And that includes government debt, plus household debt, plus corporate debt, all sorts of debt, not private credit debt, but private credit is actually a very small component of that. According to the US Congress study group confirms that is potentially $2 trillion out of several trillion dollars in the hundreds of trillion dollars that the global economy has in debt.
Hey, Ricardo, I would have argued, though, that debt to GDP has gone up dramatically. And so if there are any imbalances, it would be more on the government side than the corporate side.
So there is. So debt to GDP at the government level has gone up, mm-hmm. but the rest of the sectors, households, corporates, have come down. So debt to GDP at the consolidated level has been 100% steady, except you had a blip in 2020 on the back of the pandemic, and then it has backed down. It's actually slightly lower now than it was at the onset of the crisis in 2008.
So, Nate, what's your feeling about the cycle? How are your teams playing it?
So I'd say I agree with Charles there and what Ricardo is saying, actually. We have seen corporate balance sheets actually generically moving a lot healthier than they are. And so technically, actually, you could see some of these spreads grinding a little bit tighter because there's room for margin expansion from some of these sort of sectors and some of these companies as we sort of work our way through, especially if you're going into sort of talking about Europe, where we think we're going to see potentially lower rates as the ECB tries to sort of respond to whatever tariffs might come through. And then on the EM side as well, I mean, EM central banks have sort of been quite ahead of the curve with the Fed. And so that's created some headroom for some of these corporates that are largely domestic functioning. So actually, we could keep pushing for a little bit longer, as Charles said, and maybe it's not quite late cycle. So lots to play around within both sort of EM, DM in terms of the corporate landscape. But certainly what we are seeing is leverage levels are improving generically if I look over the last sort of decade or so, a little bit more. I mean, within European investment grade, leverage is around 2.8. And within G side of EM, leverage is only one turn. So there is a lot of scope for us to run a little bit longer.
I guess, Brian, ending with you, and just because I've been listening very closely to your answers so far, I'm guessing you're actually feeling pretty good about where you are in the credit cycle as well.
Well, I feel good about the resiliency of our markets. I think, you know, trying to ping where we are in the credit cycle is exceedingly difficult. There's just so much liquidity out there. A lot of it is a function of fiscal and monetary stimulus coming out of COVID. That traditional sort of surefire recession indicators, inverted treasury curve, leading economic indicators, manufacturing PMI, SOM rule, sort of pick your poison, they haven't worked. And at some point, that excess liquidity will come out of the market and these indicators will start working again. But we're flying a little blind from the top down. And from a bottom-up perspective, things look good. Things look like they're middle innings.
Generically, the health of the global financial sector has also much improved over the last sort of decade or so, at least over the last few years. If you think about how quickly the European banking system has really recovered post-Credit Suisse as well, we look at some of the upgrade trends that we're seeing in Europe has actually been in the banking sector. You've seen Italian banks being upgraded. You've seen some of the Spanish banks being upgraded. So actually, there's been a recovery within the global banking system as well. And the EM banks, some of them are the best capitalized they've ever been. If you look at the banking system in Mexico.
But your point is that, hey, you know, different from the GFC where panic spread throughout the banking system because it was so weak. Now we're in a much sort of post Basel III stronger banking system, harder for stress to flow through the banking system, which is usually the direction it flows. So basically justifies tighter spreads and a lower risk premium. Interesting. Okay. Keeping with the theme of this discussion, which is our navigating shifting markets, looking forward to 2025. What are the best ideas for your portfolios? What do you see for 2025 that you're really excited about putting your clients' capital to work? I'll start with Charles.
Securities are tools, right? And so different clients have different needs. And so for insurance clients in particular who have more yield and duration, there are tons of opportunities right now. And so you can find, you know, wherever you are in the curve, you know, rates have risen to the point where there are compelling opportunities, you know, sort of in the front end of the curve for annuity buyers, for the long end of the curve for whole life buyers. And then on a relative return basis, you know, spreads are tight and relationships are compressed. And so there are probably objectively less opportunities than there were last year when you saw a lot of dispersion between financial companies and industrials. And there were just a lot of idiosyncratic kinds of opportunities to invest in. That being said, If you look, and this is probably always the case, but it is still true, if you look at sort of less followed, less liquid opportunities right now, especially in the financial sector, I think there's still plenty of opportunities. And so you can still think of aircraft lessors or business development companies or some of the smaller sort of more triple B oriented insurance companies. There's still great value there. Some of the energy companies, especially the midstream sort of the pipeline companies, also seem fairly attractive. And so those companies have been reducing leverage over the last couple of years and on an increasing credit rating trend, which has been very interesting to watch. Spreads have come in, but I think they still have a fair amount of room to run and detrade, we're probably 20, 30 basis points over the index. And so those are interesting. And so there, depending on sort of what type of investor you are, there are definitely opportunities within any pocket of the credit markets. You've got some great corporate credit markets.
Ricardo, in EM Solve's best idea for 2025, go.
So we have on EM, so high yield names on US dollar bonds, interest rates in Europe, and US tips for developed market investors.
Good list, short and succinct. Tunde, what about your portfolios?
Okay. With the backdrop that 2025 is going to be about uncertainty and lack of predictability, the focus for us will be on Latin American companies with U.S.-based businesses for 2025 to benefit from that near-term U.S. exceptionalism that we potentially will get. It's focusing on defensive sectors within EM. Generically, it's the TMT sectors, it's the utility sectors. And very much like Ricardo says, it's idiosyncratic high-yield stories that we can play, credit stories where it's not necessarily going to be driven by the macro or the tariffs, all that noise that we will get. So lots of different levers to play for next year.
And Brian, favorite idea of going into 2025?
Favorite idea is long U.S. loans with a Treasury futures overlay. So we're in a carry environment. Loans have the most carry. There's not a lot of excess return in spreads at this point. But if you're worried about a step change lower in rates, you're protected via those Treasury futures. So I think a package of long loans, long Treasury futures does pretty well in most scenarios.
Keeping in the theme of a 2025 outlook, let's have one bold prediction from each of you. Let's start with Brian.
Well, if it's got to be bold, then it will probably be wrong. But I will say, no Fed cuts in 2025. Economy reaccelerates on animal spirits, and the Fed is in a little bit of a box.
I like it. Tunde.
Bold prediction is that China will come out fighting in Trump version 2.0. I don't have a crystal ball, but I think that's as bold as it gets.
Ricardo.
Russia-Ukraine war doesn't end.
Okay. Yeah, that's going against conventional wisdom, certainly the last week. And Charles.
I think we're going to see the tights and the wides for the corporate credit market in 2025. And not wide. We're not going to get past COVID. We're not going to get past great financial crisis, but up into sort of, possibly past 200, which would put you well into the crisis territory. And so I think volatility is going to return that way.
Those were indeed some bold predictions. Thank you. Okay. So let's finish off with perhaps the most important question of the discussion. Given everything we've heard today, both compelling and cautious, what advice would each of you give to an investor who's trying to navigate today's shifting landscape? Charles, let's start with you.
I would say to stay the course. And so for our insurance clients, you know, we can buy very strong, stable investment-grade companies at very, very compelling yields right now. There is a reason that money has been flowing into the asset class. And so we actually feel like we can do a very good job on the insurance side. On the relative return side, even though spreads are a little tight right now and relationships are compressed, we do feel like there are plenty of idiosyncratic credit opportunities. There are capital structure plays we can make. There are different parts of the curve we can play at, interesting relationships there. And so I think even within the relative return environment, there's still plenty of opportunities. And so again, I would stay the course and not worry about the tight spreads right now.
Thank you. Ricardo, what advice do you have for investors?
So bottom-up investing deals with the shifting landscape quite well. And that's basically what we believe it's the appropriate way to approach the current market environment, knowing the credits in which you are invested, knowing the countries where you are buying, knowing the interest rates. So our best options today seem to be tips in US, as I mentioned, high yield credit sovereign, and interest rates in Europe. But that comes from a bottom-up analysis.
Tunde, let's get your answer to this.
All right. So for me, as I said earlier, 2025 will be a year of uncertainty because whilst Trump may be the same, I think the world has changed from Trump 1.0. And so really the focus for us is about active portfolio management. It's about doing the bottom-up work to find those idiosyncratic stories, finding those winners that will benefit in that sort of scenario of a world that is different. So it, as we said earlier, it's focusing on companies that have US-based operations. So emerging market companies with US-based operations who can benefit from what we expect to be near-term US exceptionalism. It's finding those defensive credits within emerging markets. It's finding the exporters who have hard currency revenue that may benefit from a stronger dollar. It's those idiosyncratic stories, really. So the key there is to stay invested because within EM, you're getting yields of north of 6%. And within Europe, you're getting yields of sort of 3.25% range. So those kind of yield numbers are still attractive where you can still clip quite good coupons as well whilst finding those bottom-up jewels that you can find.
And finally, Brian, what advice do you have for investors?
I guess it, as it relates to the high yield market, I think it's important to remember that it's just really short. There's not a lot of price sensitivity to changes in spread. So you can feel pretty good about your carry. The market's high quality and sort of echoing other comments, it's time, not timing. Most of your total return is going to come from carry and you need to be invested to get it.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us today. If you'd like to continue this conversation, please reach out to your Barings representative for further questions. And finally, as always, thank you very much for your continued partnership.
Thanks for listening to the Barings 2025 Global Fixed Income Outlook. As mentioned up front, if you'd like to access a written version of this conversation adapted from the full discussion, please visit barings.com. And for more conversations on asset classes ranging from high yield and private credit to real estate debt and equity, please follow Streaming Income on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.